right here is for the people.
I recently went to Hawaii on honeymoon the back end of last year. Absolutely fell in love with the place. I also made a very lovely friend and a resident there on the Big Island. Funny thing is, we didn't actually meet in Hawaii, but I read an amazing article she wrote in the Big Island Chronicle just explaining about some of the atrocities of the state of corn-fed beef. So for you listeners, scroll back through some of the previous podcasts to find that one. You know, it's totally changed the way I eat. Well, after reading that article, I got in touch with Sophia, and since then we've been friends. So I wish this podcast could have taken place under happier circumstances. At a very high level, Hawaii faced a severe storm that bombarded it. It did significant damage, and I knew about it because I was following Sophia's posts on Facebook. And it actually started to get a bit weird when the story changed from storms to Sophia posting messages about poison gases leaking from power plants, you know, poisoning the community. People due to debris and trees on the roads, traveling was basically very difficult, and the lack of appropriate response as well from the authorities. So we're going to dig into that. So to help explain what happened, to help explain some of the terminology and where the situation stands today, well, we have two guests joining Sophia and I. Both have been very active in bringing this issue to light and helping to do something about it. So perhaps, Sophia, if you could introduce how you got to know Tom and Bob and maybe explain a bit, introduce them, I think that will set the scene nicely.
Well, August 7th was the night of the storm, as well as the night of the Puna geothermal gas leak. And I did not feel well following it. And I was very concerned and very upset. And I realized that during the time, there was radio announcements galore. If you needed food or ice or medical assistance, go to this resource. But there was no resource for people that were affected by the geothermal. And I had some memory of some time ago of Bob, and knowing that he was very active in the Punapuna Alliance. And I sent him a personal message and just said, hey, what's going on here? Do you know anything? What can you tell me? And he said, come to this meeting, and we're going to have a lot of conversation about it. There's a lot going on, and you should be informed. And I consider myself very fortunate because I, you know, was able to find assistance. So I came to the meeting, and Tom Travis, who's sitting next to me as well, was never laid eyes on you before. That was a couple weeks ago. And we live in a very interesting community of kind of, I would say, some colorful, sometimes fringy folk. And Tom is a very, you know, has a military background, and you know, almost looks like my Republican father. And it's very nice in this, you know, in this this difficult, very kind of liberal slanted, you know, process that we're engaged in, that we have somebody with a military background, with, you know, the kind of engineer and savvy that he brings to the table. So I just kind of jumped in and have been coming to meetings and asking these gentlemen for information and guidance, and they've been just invaluable resource for myself and lots and lots of other people. So that's how I know them.
If I might, this is Tom. If I might suggest, I would suggest that probably the best way to start is for Bob to give a 4 or 5 minute history of geothermal in the area, and then I can talk specifically about the release and why it didn't, and why it should not have occurred.
Yeah, perfect. Go for it.
Okay, this is Bob, and so in the 1950s, mid-1950s, there was a family that owned a lot of land here, the Lymans, and they got interested in geothermal, as a way to power Hawaii and make money probably also. So they began to do exploration, and they spent 20 years drilling different wells around Puna looking for geothermal. They weren't very successful. They weren't a drilling company. They weren't that well equipped. In the mid-1970s, I think the University of Hawaii got more involved, and they started doing an SOH from scientific observation holes, and they started drilling better wells or deeper wells or more professionally done. And they drilled a lot of them, and they finally found a resource, a geothermal resource near Leilani Estates, where Sophia lives. And to this day, it's the only resource that they've ever found after all of the wells they've drilled. So unfortunately for the people that live here, it happened to be right in the middle of several pre-existing residential communities. And the original experiment, they were very excited about it, and nobody understood if there were dangers from the gases. It's volcanic. We live on a volcano, so the geothermal resources in general vary widely, and they can be toxic or non-toxic, and the temperatures can be, you know, different, lower. So it depends on where you do it. And where we live on the volcano, we have one of the hottest resources and the most toxic resources on the planet. Very different than some place like Calistoga in California, or the geysers, which is the largest geothermal development in the United States. So when they drilled those wells, when you drill a well like that, there's all kinds of rock and stuff. There's things in it. It's dirty. So what they like to do is that once they hit that type of pressure, they like to just open it up and let it blow all that stuff out and clean the wells. And for another reason, they also wanted to know if the resource was going to last or if it was going to just, you know, run for two or three weeks or a month and then peter out. So they used to just let that thing go. And it's very loud. It's super high pressure. So it sounds similar to a 747 jet. Very close to your house if you're on the runway. There weren't many people here then. There were a lot of subdivision lots, but there weren't a lot of people. But in 1977, the first people started complaining about getting sick. There was a guy named Bill Reich, and he went to the newspaper with 40 people, and they said that this open venting of the geothermal plants without a well was making them ill. And since then, it's been the same story over and over for 40 years now. You know, constant, different people, different communities, but always the same kind of health issues related to geothermal. In 1981, they built the first experimental power plant right here, again, near at this well, which is very near to where Sophia and a lot of other people now live. By 1981, there were more people living there. It's a very nice community. It's beautiful. Leilani, where Sophia lives, has paved roads and utilities and that kind of stuff, which is not that common out here where we are. So people were moving in, and they began to operate that power plant, and it was bad, and everybody was complaining. They said, "Don't worry about it. We're just going to do this for 2 years. It's an experiment, and we'll shut it down." They ended up after they built that power plant, they connected to HELCO. So now they were providing.
HELCO being the local power company.
HELCO is the local Hawaiian Electric light company, mm-hmm. and the local power distributor. So all of a sudden, HELCO's getting, it was 2.5 megawatt power plant, and all of a sudden, HELCO's getting power, now reliable power, and the university is making money. So they decided after the 2 years that they weren't going to shut it down. It was very, very poorly done. It's like a third world. We're treated more like a third world country out here where, you know, Honolulu is the base of power in Hawaii, and we're on the outer islands in a relatively unpopulated rural area with no political power at that time particularly. So they ran the power plant for 8 years and made people very, very sick. I built my house before the power plant began to operate, and very near to where Sophia lives, And I had no idea about geothermal. When I heard about it, I thought it was a great thing. You know, I'm not a fan of burning oil and fossil fuels and all kind of things. So I thought it was fine. But I immediately started having problems similar to what Sophia's having and many other people. And so at that time, I was, I don't know, 21 years old or something, 22. I was pretty young. And so I went to the county. I actually believed that in government, you know, that if there was a problem like that, they would protect us. So I spent about 2 years trying to work with the county, and they told me, don't worry, don't worry. You know, we'll buy your house and we'll move you out. Just, you know, just hang in there a little while. So I talked to a number of different people at the county, and when one person couldn't placate me anymore, they would pass me to another person, and there were seven of them. So over the 2 years, I talked to seven different people, and I went around that circle twice. After the seventh person couldn't satisfy me, he put me back to the first person, and I talked to all. It took about 2 years. At the end of 2 years, I realized that they weren't going to help us. That was all about money. And so I went door to door in the neighborhood because nobody really knew what was happening, And I didn't even know the neighbors. It was very rural. And so I went door to door, and I knocked on the doors, and every family I talked to, every one of them was sick. And so I asked them to write letters, and they did. And there were 34 letters or something like that. It was quite a few. And I took them to the newspaper because nobody else would do anything. And the newspaper published those letters, and that was the beginning of this part of the geothermal battle.
And just quickly, what's the population of the Big Island?
I think it's about 160,000.
Mm-hmm. And the citizens that were in harm's way or within that kind of vicinity, is it quite a lot?
There were, at that time, it depends on the type of accident, you know, and how far you're impacted. So it would depend on the circle that you drew. Several hundred at that time. Right now, there's probably about 3,000.
One thing to know is that these guys can give maybe a better statistic on it. We have residents next to the Puna Geothermal Venture within roughly a half a mile, and all other geothermal plants worldwide have, you know, like a 10-mile buffer zone.
No, that's not true.
That's not true? What is it?
It varies. It really varies. And like we say, the resources are different. But some places, they usually have some type of buffer zone, but there is no predetermined movement that I'm aware of.
To my knowledge, there's no standard buffer zone worldwide. What I can say is that I know of no place that has the type of resource Hawaii has, where they have people within half a mile.
Yeah, Russell said it's the most toxic with the closest proximity.
Yes.
So that is at least true.
In third world countries, they have similar situations, but I think even there, they have more space between the plants a lot of time.
Also, something to consider is that the Puna district that we're in is the fastest growing of all the Hawaii Island chain districts. We have more people moving here. It's the most affordable, and we have the least amount of infrastructure and resource and political power and probably anybody, like you mentioned.
I'll pick up the story and say that after the original plant was shut down after massive protests and a lot of people started to get sick.
How long ago was that? Sorry, Tom.
In 1989, the power plant was finally shut down by emergency decree by Governor Waihe'i after Labor Day. There was a particularly bad accident on the weekend of Labor Day weekend in 1989, and so that's what it took to shut it down.
And then what they did is, since they had a geothermal resource, they decided to build a new power plant. One that wasn't a research and development plant like this one was, that was poorly run, that they got a company to come in, and the company came in and actually built a power plant on the resource. They changed the way the resource, the way they drew power, whereas the original research plant had just dumped steam into the air. This new plant was going to condense the water from the steam, the geothermal steam, and then pump it back into the ground. So it'd be a closed cycle. Steam and water comes up, water, hot water, very hot water and pressure comes up, expands into steam when the pressure drops. It's used to produce power, condensed back into water, and then pumped back down into the geothermal resource for reheating. So that was the general cycle of the new plant. While they were drilling the new plant in 1991, they had what was called a well blowout. And essentially, they drilled a well into this very hot water, 400 and some degree Fahrenheit, under enormous pressure. And they lost control of it. It blew the top of the well head off. And so now they had an uncontrolled leak. And before they got that stopped, they were dumping geothermal fluid through this 9 to 12 inch hole for about 31 hours. And that was in 1991. As a result of that, a lot of studies were done. Most people around the community thought that that was the end of geothermal air because of the size of the accident. The number of people that got sick in this case were spread out over miles, 5-6 miles from the plant, with potential effects. Follow-on study said it, potential effects could be as far as 10 miles from the plant. So in any case, I wasn't here, but the geothermal forces regrouped, and they began again operations in 1993. From 1993 to 1999, they had, 17 civil defense, declared civil defense emergencies. The civil defense director during that period of time was a guy named Harry Kim, who Bob and I both know very well. And so they kept track of it. In about 1999, I think it was, Harry Kim was moved on and was no longer civil defense director. From that period of time until the present, they've kept inadequate records, so it is very difficult to tell how many civil defense emergencies there have been. That there have been on the order of 62 unplanned releases, most of which were not too significant, but 4 or 5 of which were significant, including a big fire in, was that 2004? I think the big fire in 2004 and releases. To get you up to speed, and March 13th on 2013, about a year and a half ago, Helco was doing maintenance on one of two transmission lines that take power from the geothermal plant and deliver it to the rest of the island. Either of the transmission lines is adequate to carry full power, but they have two transmission lines installed so they can do maintenance and they have backup. Well, on March 13th, they were actually doing maintenance on one of the lines, and the second line was impacted by a tree, I think. It may have been a fault, but in any case, the second line failed. And so the geothermal plant went from its design power of 38 megawatts to 0 megawatts instantly. That caused a high pressure condition in the geothermal plant. And the plant had to be protected by a system called the Emergency Steam Relief System. The Emergency Steam Relief System releases geothermal fluid plus all the hydrogen sulfide and other noxious and toxic gases to the air in the community, and it does it through what's called an abatement filter. If that filter is working correctly, that filter removes 94% of the hydrogen sulfide. And the claims have always been, the claim on March 13th was that it worked correctly. I don't have any reason to disbelieve that claim. The abatement process involves shooting caustic soda into the stream of geothermal fluid. And the caustic soda absorbs the hydrogen sulfide and converts it to other things. The second thing the caustic soda does, though, is that it attaches itself to heavy metals. In fact, caustic soda is used in heavy metal cleaning. And if there's any carryover of that caustic soda, some of the heavy metals may be attached to the caustic soda and go into the neighborhood. So there's been a potential for a long time that that caustic soda could have been causing heavy metal to be introduced into the community.
What do you mean by heavy metal?
Heavy metals are lead, mercury,
cadmium, tin.
Yeah. Yeah, and these metals, lead's most well known, that plutonium, all of these metals have very bad effects on the body if they're in the body. And so the Department of Health has been asked to monitor the caustic soda, but they never have. So whether there is heavy metal contamination, I know it's possible from the physical processes involved, but whether there is heavy metal contamination has never been investigated and determined.
So can you explain what happens then if you suffer from exposure to that?
I'm not a medical expert, but I think Sophia might be able, I think she understands some of that.
Heavy metals are very interesting because they mimic minerals that your body wants. So something like, I'm not sure if it's accurate, say mercury, your body might uptake it thinking it's calcium or something like that. And it gets stored deeply and is very, very difficult to mobilize and excrete correctly. And once it's in your system, it starts to wreak havoc. They're commonly referred to as endocrine disruptors. So any kind of metabolic process, any kind of hormonal, regulatory, anything of that nature, adrenal, thyroid, can scramble your entire system. And again, they're very, very difficult to remove. Different PCBs are even easier to remove from your system than heavy metals. They get stored. Your body actually hangs on to them. So once you have them, one of the things that they do is they deplete your adrenals. And when your adrenals are depleted, if you don't have online adrenals, you can't detox your heavy metals. So it's kind of a terrible catch-22. And it's prevalent. I mean, if you were to go and Google heavy metal toxicity, everybody's got some form of heavy metals. It's kind of just common this day and age, unfortunately. However, living so close to a plant that's spewing them certainly doesn't help others.
Yeah. And I would also comment that heavy metal contamination sometimes is a fancy way to say lead poisoning. Because lead poisoning, that's where awareness is, as we came to understand what lead does to people, that's where the awareness of heavy metals started. So it's the most famous of the heavy metal poisonings. In any case, on March 13th, they lifted the relief and it lifted for 17 minutes. And spewed these things into the air, and after the 17 minutes, it secured, and Punapono Alliance called a meeting asking the various players to come and explain what happened. And three pertinent issues came out. One is that none of the monitoring system reported any abnormalities beyond the state specification. And the reason for that is when the relief valve lifts, the steam and hot gases go up into the air, and after they cool, they can come down in other places. But the only monitors available are very, very close. So the gases went right over the top of the samplers that are needed. So the first thing I want to note about the March 13th is even though a substantial amount, not necessarily a health threat, but a measurable amount of hydrogen sulfide was released. None was detected by the to exceed the regulatory limits by the State Department of Health. However, portable samples indicated limits almost 100 times the Department of Health limit in the community with when portable samplers were used. So that's the first thing I'd like to note. The second thing is that the plant design is such that when it goes from high load to no load, the only protection it has is this relief valve. So it is very predictable that if you lose power, and this is, you know, an outage in a remote city somewhere, but if you lose power, you're not only going to have that outage, but the geothermal plant will lift release and dump geothermal fluids and toxins into the neighborhood. The third thing I'd like to note is that as a result of that incident, the head of the Hawaiian Electric Light Company, Jay Ignacio, promised the community that they would be careful and always have a backup before they did maintenance on the plant. In other words, they weren't going to take out one of the transmission lines in the future. And he apologized to the community and said, in the future, we won't do that to you again. So along comes the night of August 7th, and we have what turned out to be a tropical storm. It was a hurricane approaching. And I don't think that there are too many people in the educated world that probably would be surprised to find that you lose electricity during hurricanes and tropical storms. So you would think that it would be very predictable that they're going to lose power. So with the understanding of what happened on March 13th, it would seem reasonable that anyone with a concern about the community and a reasonable understanding of what's going to happen would shut the geothermal plant down. A third thing that we know is that any time, this is a rural community, and any time we have even a severe local storm, the roads all get blocked up. So it was absolutely predictable that the tropical storm was going to make road passage impossible. So with all those pieces together, I told my wife 2 days before the storm arrived, she said, do we need to worry about PGD and the geothermal plant? And I said, honey, they're not stupid enough to run that during the hurricane. Well, shame on me, because they ran it, and they ran it at substantial power.
Yeah.
And so when the power was lost, the emergency steam release lifted. And in this case, because it was nighttime, and because the geothermal plant also lost its local electricity because of damage from the storm, it took them about an hour and 15 minutes to secure the dumping that geothermal brine into the community. Additionally, when they secured the emergency steam relief system, they found out that an additional relief valve, the pulse had been high enough to lift an additional relief valve that was releasing unabated. That means the 94% wasn't removed from that. So there's an additional path, 6 inches big, shooting pure unabated sulfide into the community. The civil defense said we have an uncontrolled leak. They told the community they had an uncontrolled leak, and they told the community, those that had some way of knowing what civil defense was saying, because there's a lot of electricity, internet, a lot of things are out, mm-hmm. that some people are still getting messages. They tell a community to evacuate. Well, I don't know where they thought they were going to go, to the first road that had a tree on it. So nobody could evacuate. In fact, the community that was affected couldn't get out of there for 2 days, roughly 2 days. Yeah. And so we're dumping this gas into a community, and it was totally preventable and totally predictable.
It was also the highest, we believe it was the highest release since the 1991 blowout because of that unabated 6-inch valve. And that unabated 6-inch valve actually went on for about an hour and 45 minutes.
An hour and 45 minutes, yes.
Well, I wonder if they can calculate based on the width of the hole and that, you know, the time and the pressure that it was coming out, you know, how much did actually get.
They're required to calculate that. It hasn't been released yet. They've made initial claims that they expect the release value to be less than the value on March 13th. So what they're telling the press is that a 17-minute leak on March 16th put out more hydrogen sulfide than an hour and 15-minute leak, plus an hour and 45-minute of unabated leak on the night of the storm. You know, it's the idea, again, the only conclusion one can come to is the people that believe it. No reasonable man can really believe that, so they must be being a bit disingenuous.
Putting it mildly.
Yeah, because I work for the security industry, and I know that IT security industry, and when a machine goes down like that, you know, one of the big mainframes, one of the servers goes down, you know, you naturally have a backup. And so much so that if you don't, and, you know, the business gets affected, there could be some penalties, financial penalties. And it seems that something like this, where there's human health at risk as well, that...
It would seem. One of the things that, you know, I've been doing this kind of crash course, these guys know so much more, is that, you know, exactly that point. You would think that some sort of agency would be holding them accountable. I from everything I can see, for example, the Department of Health, has got their fingers in their ears going la 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 la. They really have not been holding them accountable.
Well, if I might interrupt, they've not only not held them accountable, they have talked to the press and says there's no possibility of anyone's health being harmed. They've said that without interviewing any of the people that are affected. They've said that without any knowledge of the amount released. They've said that only based on their conjecture of what they think the effects will be. So a no evidence press release telling everybody in the community that they couldn't have been had any effects.
Can I interject here? Ormat Geothermal is the owner of the Puna Geothermal Power Plant, and they're the largest geothermal corporation in the world. And they have a lot of political power. They have plants all over the world. And their two top lobbyists came out of Senator Harry Reid's office in Nevada. In 2011, Ormat was able to get almost $900 million from the government. $178 million was direct cash from the Department of the Treasury. That's a grant. A $350 million loan guarantees, and another $350 million in partial loan guarantees, part of which were used to bail out investors in trouble to geothermal power plants. I can't overestimate the political power of this corporation in Hawaii, especially someplace that's, that has no political power as Hawaii has. Who knows?
Go ahead.
I kind of would like to, if possible, recount my experience, because I was one of the people that was trapped in gas, and I think that might bring some context to the story. One thing is that we here in Hawaii, we most of the time hurricanes, you know, threaten us. We get some wind storms and we don't really get hit that hard. But everybody kind of saw this was coming. This one was going to be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like everybody, I had my water, I had my flashlights, and I had my animals inside. And I, you know, just figured going to get some downed trees, power outage, and probably, you know, no, it wouldn't be that bad. Well, as it turns out, the storm pretty much beelined for Kapoho and Leilani and a few other areas. Hilo, for example, didn't get hit whatsoever. And the night of the storm, the power had gone out about 3:30 or so, and I was sitting in the dark in my house, and thankfully had my cell phone, and that was my saving grace. As Tom mentioned, one of the things that I found so infuriating was that there was no information. Most people had access to no understanding. The only thing new is that we kept on hearing explosions and the sound of a jet engine off in the distance, which didn't match up with the hurricane. So I'm sitting here in the dark with my phone, and a friend on Facebook, of all people, notifies me that there's a leak in the geothermal. Mm-hmm. I had already been feeling sick and couldn't figure out why. And I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, this is really bad. I got calls from friends and they said, you got to get out of there. And I said, I know I'm not going to be able to. I went next door. I have a small house that somebody lives in next door. I notified him. He was literally completely in the dark. He had no cell phone service, no internet, no nothing. You know, he had a flashlight. And he had been feeling ill as well. One thing to note is that the hydrogen sulfide gas loves low-lying areas. It's a dense gas. So it cools and kind of collects in lower-lying areas. Where I am is kind of in a bowl. So, as well as some other people that experienced severe health impacts were also in this similar bowl. Higher elevations, it's not as problematic. I was terrified. I could feel it, and I literally felt trapped. There was a tree blocking my driveway, so I couldn't even get out past my driveway. Mm-hmm. Had I been able to get past my driveway, I couldn't have gotten much further down the street. So evacuating was a non-issue. I contacted the police and fire departments, and they merely said, if you feel uncomfortable, you should evacuate, which was kind of like a condescending slap in the face. I had no choice. I decided to stay, and all of a sudden I became very sleepy in the middle of a storm with the adrenaline rush of a gas leak. And someone who has very bad insomnia, and I passed out. And we're finding that other people who were exposed to high levels also had a similar experience of passing out. My renter, my neighbor, also both passed out as well. And I awoke the next morning, and I felt terrible. And my brain has been certainly not as clear. I've had a lot of pain in my chest. I went to my doctor. She diagnosed me with reactive pneumonia from exposure to the gases. Mm-hmm. And I have not been well since.
Is it like almost a smoky effect where you kind of feel like coughing, or is it something different?
You can't get a full breath, and there's pain in my chest and a soreness in my throat, and just a general fatigue. Mm-hmm. Also, my doctor said one of the very, it's very common if you've been exposed to hydrogen sulfide to kind of be, what did she say? She said, like apathetic, like completely lacking motivation. You're pretty drained. It's, another physician that came to one of the meetings said it's akin to cyanide poisoning. It does mitochondrial damage. Mm-hmm. Another thing to know is that our local medical resources, you know, have no knowledge or training about this. So people in the community have gone to their physicians and say, hey, I'm not feeling well. I've got all this, you know, respiratory stuff, and I think I might have been exposed to some gases. And since people have no knowledge or training in it, they go, oh, you know, take some extra vitamin C and you'll be fine. So people aren't really getting a lot of people aren't finding that they're getting the help or the understanding of this, you know, this issue medically.
Yeah, the fact that it's 2014 and that's still the case, you know, when everyone's on social media and basically everyone has access to the whole World Wide Web, you know, through their phones and their mobile devices. So, you know, for basic things like that, not to be, you know, to be updated regularly so that for scenarios like this, you know, that education and training could be implemented and, you know, potentially lives could be saved. You know, so,
well, you know, they never have implemented an emergency response plan, a functional emergency response plan, even after over 30 years of this stuff. And Punapono Alliance went to the county council about 2 years ago, and we got an emergency response plan passed, or a plan for that they were going to have to implement. And the mayor, the current mayor, vetoed that. And then he came up with his own emergency response plan, which is what was in effect the night of the hurricane.
Which is do nothing?
Pretty much. another thing you might want to realize here is that we pay the highest electric rates in the United States right here. So this is very much about money. And HEI, the parent company of Helco, has been one of the most profitable companies in Hawaii for decades. They don't want to let go of that. And it appears to be that they're willing to sacrifice this community in order to make that money. Another thing that I don't think has been mentioned yet is that when PGV lost power, they lost all monitoring. Department of Health, there was no samplers. They have the four samplers that are inadequate as is. But even after all of these years, they've never, and us asking, they've never put in a backup power supply for any of that sampling equipment. As soon as PGV lost power, there is no data, no official data of what the levels were in the community.
I'd like to talk. Bob and I were on a group called the Geothermal Public Health Assessment Working Group. And we spent about 2 years as volunteers researching what is known medically about hydrogen sulfide. And I will just pass on to you that hydrogen sulfide has two effects. One is respiratory, and the second effect is it's a neurotoxin. Mm-hmm. And it's as a neurotoxin that it's believed to be fatal. Very high concentrations. H2S appears to make the body unable to do the things it needs to do to stay alive. Mm-hmm. So it's called it happens in one or two breaths, death from hydrogen sulfide. Very, very potent. That's at very, very high levels, much higher than the ones we had that are reasonable here during the storm. But at lesser levels, there are many studies that show that there are neurological effects as well, that it affects the cognitive ability of the mind. It affects the ability of the senses to deal appropriately. In other words, color blindness, it can cause color blindness. It causes a decrease in balance. It can cause types of paralysis. It also has a very bad effect on pregnant women. Although that's not proven, there's anecdotal evidence, and the EPA says that it's very important that be looked into. So there are two levels of effects. One's the respiratory effects, and in general, many of the respiratory effects will clear if the people leave the area and are gone for a long time. The body will heal and they'll probably overcome most of those effects. The neurological effects, there are studies that indicate that there is no healing for the neurological effects. And so the damage done to a community neurologically is permanent unless that damage is identified and medical intervention is taken to try to help the people recover some of their capability.
Yeah. What stands out to me is that the previous incidences of this kind of exposure, you know, as you said, the effects, I think it's very difficult to kind of to identify them and to pinpoint them out. But I think now that we have a bit more understanding about it, the recent effects, have there been any fatalities?
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know that we can. There was one person died a week after the storm, but I don't think that we can tie that to this yet, where there is an autopsy being done, and so I wouldn't say that. But historically, over the last several years, last 20 years or so, there was one death in particular, a man named Bud Breeze, that was in one of the most highly impacted areas. He died of edema, respiratory edema, some kind of lung problem. The community believes that that was possibly a result of his repeated exposures, but we've never been able to get any help from any regulatory agency to pursue that. And part of that, I think, is that if you look at this is a lot bigger than Hawaii. Hydrogen sulfide is a product that's produced by landfills, wastewater treatment, geothermal, oil and gas, paper and pulp, chemical plants, beer manufacturing, and some electronic manufacturing, among others. So it's a huge worldwide industry. If hydrogen sulfide is a danger to people, all of those industries will have to be retrofitted. So I think what we're facing here, most of the studies that if you do research in what you were on the committee that we were on, most of the studies will determine that the results are inconclusive. They can't determine if you're hurt by the H2S or if you're not hurt by the H2S. And this has been going on for 50 years or more. So we're kind of worried that because of the amount of influence and money of all of these corporations, that if it is determined that the hydrogen sulfide from cooling geothermal is actually hurting these people, that then oil and gas, et cetera, will also have to deal with that.
And to put that in perspective, the pattern we're seeing with hydrogen sulfide, in other words, industry-funded studies that are inconclusive or don't support past studies that showed harm. Mm-hmm. All of that is a pattern that if you're old enough, we've all seen with research on DDT and research on tobacco. All of those follow the same pattern. So hydrogen sulfide may be the new tobacco.
Yeah, and just the companies and the industries you're mentioning, it's a very much a David Goliath situation.
Yeah, a company like Exxon makes more money in a quarter than the gross domestic product of most of Hawaii for a year. I mean, you know, these companies are way bigger even than the state. Mm-hmm. They're probably not bigger than the country, but they're pretty big.
So a term I'm hearing a lot as I'm reading through this is scared and pissed, I guess is the way that people are feeling about it now. The way that within a year, not only did the time it takes to fix the error increase, you know, an hour and 15 minutes, but it just shows that, you know, working with this kind of technology, there are never any certainties. And it should have, you know, red flags all over it. But I mean, I can understand now, you know, why the people are so angry. You know, people like, even you, Sophia, I listened to one of our old podcasts today, and you mentioned this, you know, your fear about, you know, this industry in particular.
Well, I think it's even more grossly negligent than that, in that they could control a lot of these things. They could put in a real system to monitor this stuff. And in their permits, they're required to use what's called BACT, Best Available Control Technology. But it comes down to, again, money. It's cheaper to do this. And after the blowout, there were over 130 people that sued for that. And they were... they settled those lawsuits. Mm-hmm. But that was just the cost of doing it. It cost PG&E about $2 million for that. Mm-hmm. But that is considered a cost of doing business.
Including hurting people.
Yeah, wasn't there some tobacco companies as well? I think there was a famous movie about it where, you know, the cost of, you know, getting sued by certain people was inferior to that if they had to invest and do something else. And, you know, they make a business decision and it's insane. So what's going to happen now then?
Good question.
Well, one thing for the listeners, there is a great video that kind of summarizes this very well, this whole situation, what happened. You can see it on the if you go to the bigislandvideonews.com website. I'll put a link to it under this episode. But it shows Tom and Sophia as well in that, so you get to see their faces and, you know, it explains it very well.
One thing I also wanted to mention, this is kind of how I found out more about the geothermal. I moved into this property in 2007. I knew there was a geothermal plant. I assumed, you know, that it would be in safe operation and the government would regulate it. Then I learned of this thing called the Pune Geothermal Relocation Program, which was if you live within a 1 mile radius, and you feel uncomfortable living close to the plant, you can be bought out and relocated. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know much about that. So that's when I started investigating, and that's when I started learning about some of the, you know, the historical, you know, EPA violations and just people getting sick. And I had no idea. And I applied for this relocation program. Mm-hmm. This is back around 2012. And they got back to me and said, oops, well, there's no money in there, so we have no alternative for you, so forget it, basically. And that's a common thing that that they've said. So they've made this lovely statement that they're willing to relocate people, except that there's no money in the fund. They went and spent it on other projects. So there's, I don't even know how many people are on the relocation.
I believe there's 40 people on the relocation list. I was part of the community effort when they permitted the project. When they permitted the project, we raised all of these issues, you know, setbacks, buffer zones, monitoring, relocation. And as a bone to us, they gave us two funds. One was a relocation fund and one was an asset fund to deal with other problems like health studies and stuff like that. I applied for that fund, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, a lot of people applied for the fund, but over the first 15, until several years ago, only two or three people at the most had ever been able to actually get relocated. And when I applied for the relocation, they came to my house and they said, well, you know, you have to fix this and you're going to have to fix that. And you know, we can't do it unless you do all these different things, which I did. And that went on for several years. And finally, I never got relocation. I had $225,000 invested in my house. I sold my house with full disclosure why for $75,000 because I just had to get out of it at that point. I just decided that I couldn't wait. And I'd been there a long time and they weren't going to help me. And then after the March 13th incident, you know, everybody in the community was upset again. And the mayor came out for his regular meeting here on another issue. And we all showed up there and started, you know, really going after him. And at that point, they did relocate a couple of people and they restarted the relocation program. But now it's been two or three people and everybody else is just out of luck.
And it's hard to believe. I mean, you guys are not the finances better. It's hard to believe that they actually don't have money. I mean, there's gotta be money someplace. You know, there's gotta be money someplace. So, so after this August 7th event, I am going to start pursuing that again. And, I'm sure I'm far down on the list, but it's a very sad and hard feeling to realize I don't feel like I can live on this property any longer safely. I don't see, they're not accountable. They're not transparent. they don't keep their word, and they don't have regard for the safety of the community. They just don't. And I can't live that close any longer to it. And it's very sad. It's very, very sad. And I'm not alone. There's a lot of people like myself that feel this way.
From what I read, doesn't seem that difficult actually to have avoided this. I think one of the questions I'd written down earlier was, you know, why was the plant still operational?
That was what Tom was addressing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you say the educated world can't even fathom. It's so predictable.
But if this is going to save me so many lawsuits and it's going to, you know, keep my company out of the newspapers and, you know, stop hurting people's lives, then it seemed like a simple few procedures, you know, and given that it only happened last year, that it would, it just seemed insane.
The other night I met with Bob, and he pulled out a folder of newspaper clippings spanning back from 1977, mm-hmm. just one after the other of people getting sick, of EPA violations, of this incident, of that incident. There is a very clear historic context, and still the people in power are not paying attention.
Well, what we got for that is the State Department of Health declared us as rapidly anti-geothermal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, apparently we were born that way.
Yeah, I was going to say that if you read in the environmental justice field, what you find is that there are often poor communities that are picked out by the business and the governments, and those communities are sacrificed to the profit. And if you want to be generous, to the good of the rest. And almost all of the characteristics of a sacrificial community can be applied to Puna. Yeah. It has substandard medical care. It has substandard roads for its population. It has substandard educational facilities. You can go down the list, and it is clear that I don't think anybody had a conference and said, let's declare Puna a sacrificial area. But it's clear that in the scheme of things, Puna has become a sacrificial community mm-hmm. to many big business and government interests.
Yeah, and it's not just that you guys know more about this. It's not just that this one particular well is the end game. There's been talks about future wells. I mean, this whole area is literally a hotbed of volcanic activity, and it's very, very disturbing for those of us that live here.
An interesting fact: Puna, the district of Puna, uses 6.3 megawatts. The last time I looked at the figures, the geothermal power plant puts out 38 megawatts. So you need to understand that the idea of geothermal is not to provide electricity to the poor people in Puna. Mm-hmm. In fact, the people in Puna live off the grid at a higher rate than almost anywhere else in the state. The fact of the matter is that those that are favoring geothermal are saying Puna people need to be willing to accept what's happening to them so that we can use this wonderful thing, geothermal power, to power the new hotel developments, power the new housing subdivisions across the island of Hawaii. But it gets even worse than that, in that they propose there are proposals for inter-island cables, big electrical cables, so they would use Puna's geothermal to help power Honolulu and other places that don't have it. So I don't think any of those plans are very realistic economically, but I do know that people have been working on them, and the government has been putting them forward as a economic future for at least the last 20 years.
Yeah, when you think of petroleum and having to go offshore often to dig it up, and those private companies that do it, but when it's inland, you know, it's almost robbing the people, you know, of, you know, if we've discovered a way to generate energy.
Well, you know, Puna also has an oil-fired power plant. Is it 20 megawatts? I believe we produce another 20 megawatts here. So of the total on the island, the demand is 180 megawatts. And in Puna, we produce over 50 megawatts there. We use, like Tom said, about 6 megawatts.
Yeah.
And so we pay for that with the oil-fired plant as well.
And curiously, we have lots and lots of abundant sunshine. You know, it's just funny, every once in a while I think, gee, it's not like there's not an alternative, you know. You know, if there wasn't an alternative, this would be maybe a different conversation. But knowing, you know, especially after the recent storm, I think people are installing solar systems and missed. But it's so much more reasonable than relying on this not clean, quote-unquote, sustainable form of energy.
Yeah.
How much solar do we have? It's 179.
Yeah, I went and looked. I could not find the citation for 179. The citation I found was 153.
In the last 2 years.
No, that's 1 year.
Okay, well.
That's 2013.
In 2013, we added 153 megawatts of solar power in Hawaii. And they've been fighting since 1991 to try to add another geothermal power plant. And since 1991, they haven't been able to add another geothermal power plant. And they're fighting for a 25 megawatt or possibly a 50 megawatt power plant. Yet this year, I think we're projected to install more every year. In fact, in 2012, I know they doubled the amount. It's about doubling. Solar's going crazy. Me and Tom both live on solar off the grid. Like he said, we have one of the largest solar communities in the state of Hawaii. We could be a model for them. In fact, we've offered. We said, hey, you know, because the state argues that this is green, clean, and we need to be renewable, and we have to get off of oil. And so we took it to the legislature and said, hey, you know, if that's really what you want to do, Puna is a model community for you, because you have thousands and thousands of people that live completely off-grid, and it's functional. We can show you how to do it.
Yeah.
But they don't want to hear it.
That'd be so awesome, educating the residents there to develop their own solar panels and get their own energy source.
Well, that's what's happening. What's happening is Helco peaked in 2007. That was the most power they sold. Since 2007, they've been selling less power every year because people are voting with their wallets and they're leaving the grid. And it's not because of geothermal. It's because we pay the highest rates in the United States, and solar prices are just crashing. You know, I mean, solar right now here, panels are under $1 a watt to buy the panels, and in 1999, that was $10 a watt.
Mm-hmm.
So economically, it makes sense for people that live here to go solar. And we can't get any help from the government for that. Like, they'll give PGV $900 million, but they won't come out here and give us 10 cents.
No.
Yeah, I would like to say that you're tripping on something that you can probably do another podcast on, but the electric utility industry has been downgraded by Barclays and several other big investment banks. And the reason that they've been downgraded, Hawaii is the worst. Helco and HBI companies are the worst. The reason they're downgraded is because the phenomenon that Bob talked about is a death spiral. The more people that go off and do solar, the higher cost of electricity, because a lot of that is infrastructure, that, and you're dividing the infrastructure cost of fewer people. And so more and more people then go off the grid, and it's called it's a death spiral. And that is discussed, like I say, the financial institutions, the investment banks have downgraded the utility bonds across the country, and they've actually come out and said, Morgan Stanley came out and said that the Hawaiian utilities may not be able to adjust fast to prevent their demise.
If I were to do it all over again, I would definitely be off-grid, which I get to do again. Who knows?
The insane thing is, you know, even when I was a young kid at school, I had these little calculators that, you know, so little, these tiny little solar panels, and I always wondered, you know, how big could you scale that out? And where would you need to be? And if you just look at the rate of which technology has advanced in all fields, you look at space travel, you look at, you know, the storage capabilities on a handheld phone, you know, they have way more, you know, storage than big, huge machines did, you know, even 10, 20 years ago.
Well, you know, what Tom was talking about is also as utilities around the country and around the world move to what's called distributed power, which is alternative producing powers into communities as opposed to large power plants. The power plants have to, you've probably heard of it, have to introduce what's called smart grid technology. Smart grid technology regulates the flow of power in different directions, and it's very, very expensive, billions and billions of dollars. So as the customer base shrinks, the costs are going to continue to rise. Yeah. So solar prices will continue to drop, as we've seen historically. They're dropping every year because you have now a worldwide market. Trillions of dollars are up for grabs around the world as people see, you know, the future. What is the future? It's not going to be dinosaur type large power plants with wires strung all over that monopolize that power. No, the power is going to be produced in the communities, on the buildings. Yeah. And so you have universities and China and Taiwan and countries, India, Mexico. They're all of them, if you go online and you look, they're all experimenting with all different types of batteries and solar. And it's amazing. You can't even keep track of it because I try. If you don't pay attention for a month, you're behind the curve already. And there's so much money there in that it's inevitable that the grids are going to collapse, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's very much, I don't know if you're old enough. I don't know how old you are.
33 years old.
In the 90s, when I visited Italy, I learned that Italy's only about 15% of the people in Italy had phones, and that the phone company in Italy was in trouble because everybody was going south. And now, of course, that's the way it is in the United States. There are large percentage of people that don't even care about having a landline anymore. So the same thing, the same sort of spiral, and of course that put the phone companies in trouble. The same thing's going to happen to the utility companies. I'd just like to give you a picture. I'm not done with building everything yet, but I'm going to save myself $200 a month to replace my gas car with an electric car that I can charge with cheap solar panels. And it'll save me $200 a month. And that's including the additional cost of the electric car and everything. So in the future, if you can imagine, the average family will charge their electric cars using solar, and essentially they'll drive for nothing more than the cost of doing maintenance for the miles they drive, because the miles will be free.
I think, you know, what we're seeing is the future. If you look at other countries, and Hawaii has the best solar resource, or one of the best solar resources around, and we should and could be leading, but instead, because of the energy monopoly and the mentality that supports that, I think we're using what appears to me to be 18th century technology, where you nail a wire to a tree, which is what they did with the first telegraph. So here, like you say, we're going to the moon, and we're, you know, we're doing all this space exploration and all this high tech stuff, and we're still nailing wires to trees.
Yeah, and it's just, well, what is, you know, there's this massive, massive archaic infrastructure in place that, you know, once it starts to get threatened, there's so many people that can be affected, and you know, there's so many interests that can be affected as well. And it's, you know, there is this, there's almost this phase now with the information and people getting educated that there is at least a bit more exposure, and the balance of power is slightly shifting. I don't think it takes too many geniuses to get together and design, you know, a car with, you know, solar panels all over. It looks like, so it's a sleek and modern design. You know, it wouldn't be that difficult, you know. But why are boosts in that kind of, in solar energy, why are they being held back? You know, what is that reason? And I think that is starting to become more and more exposed, or at least discussed.
I can tell you, in Hawaii, energy policy is designed to benefit the people in power, the corporations in power, as opposed to being designed what's best for the people. And I think that's really evident in that we pay the highest rates in the United States.
By the way, do you know the number one business in Hawaii, the biggest business?
No.
The biggest business is Hawaii Electric. Hawaii Electric Companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's the biggest business. It's the biggest corporation in Hawaii.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's not surprising either. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard stories about, or read recently about Tesla trying to get, you know, his vehicles, you know, up and running and out, available to people, and just different people trying to blockade, access to it. And it's just fascinating because it seems like a pretty great model. You know, especially, I don't know about Hawaii as much, but on the mainland where you can have these charging stations and, you know, travel for long distances, that people would be in opposition to it seems kind of odd.
So if I wanted to show some support and, you know, and help, how can I do that? You know, if I'm a listener and, you know, how do I find out more and how can I support?
Punapono Alliance. It's Punapono Alliance has a website, and it's, you'll be disgusted with it. It's a little bit clumpy.
No, but I will put an easy link to that.
Enormous. It's being used by researchers and everybody else. There's all sorts of information. If there's also email addresses on that website, mm-hmm. that people could reach, and depending upon what they could offer, you know, additional media coverage, financial help, whatever, and all of it can be used. But email addresses are available on that website to get in touch with us if people were interested in helping.
Yeah, and I can certainly pass on any emails or any requests that come through the website.
Yeah.
It seems like exposure is one of the things that we, you know, is the most helpful. You know, we're in this small community, and as we've kind of alluded to, kind of like forgotten about, and a lot of people don't know this story, and it's specific to us, but I think there's a broader theme going on about, you know, power industry. And so, I know that was one of the things that was really attractive about doing this podcast, was that it's a, you know, it's a nice story that can be then shared, you know, emailed or posted or whatever it is. And, you know, I personally would love for more people to know and understand it. And there's, you know, one of the things is I've recently been becoming involved, and these guys know it all too well. I'm surprised when you objectively review some of the facts, how many people are still, you know, in complete denial, like a cognitive dissonance, that of course, you know, it's renewable energy, it should be fine. I mean, there are plenty of people in my neighborhood that, you know, think it's just, you know, the bee's knees.
I thought it was till I heard about this.
Sure. I mean, who doesn't like the idea of renewable energy? If it were clean, that would be a different story, though. And it's unfortunately not. And it's, you know, it's messy and it's... Yeah. Oh, yeah. He Bob left the room for a minute. I'll just let him know. He asked, what would be, if we can offer support and help?
I really don't know. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I'm glad that the message is getting out widely, and thank you for that. But
you mentioned the website.
Yeah, I don't have an answer. I don't know.
Okay, well, one key thing I'm certainly going to take away is that this hydrogen sulfide, this kind, you know, this discharge, that I didn't realize that was also the byproduct in so many other industries. You know, so you're right; it's not simply an issue there in Hawaii, but
There's also quite a few other chemicals, as we talked about with the heavy metals. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, as molten lava is outgassing things like radon, mercury vapor, and none of that is tested for or abated in any way. The only thing that they treat is the hydrogen sulfide, which is the signature gas because you can smell it. Mm-hmm. Anytime there's a geothermal emission, you can smell that. It smells like rotten eggs.
Yeah.
Isn't it what I want to say? I heard recently it's one of the top three most toxic substances.
I believe when I read it was more toxic than hydrogen cyanide.
Yeah. It's so, higher on the list than cyanide, but I'm not sure what their criteria is for rating poisons.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, we definitely appreciate the support. Any kind of, you know, just sharing the information, sharing the story. You know, and it's unfortunate because I think that we're one of many communities that are kind of forgotten about and are fighting a really challenging battle. And we shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
That's the unfortunate thing. We shouldn't have to be in this position. And I'm so grateful for these two gentlemen and the work that they do and being an advocate and resource for so many people, because like I said, after the storm, I was so confused. I said, what do I do? Who do I talk to? You know, there was no support offered. And finding these guys and a number, you know, of my neighbors nearby are also in the same boat too. So grateful for them. Absolutely. I know you wanted to ask a question. I'm not going to be able to answer it about the approaching lava flow.
Yeah. How insane. I mean, you know, for the listeners, you know, don't forget that Hawaii is basically a volcano, you know, and the Big Island, you know, when I was there, went to visit a huge volcano, Kilauea. And then you can't actually,
we're sitting on top of it right now.
It's insane. You're sitting on top of a volcano, right? And, so in the news, it's saying that there's a lava flow. So what's going on there?
The main crater for the Kilauea volcano is called Halemaumau.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the headquarters of Volcano National Park, for those that have been here. Down the road a ways, off into the forest, is a place called Pu'u'o'o. And it started dumping lava, this vent that's associated with Kilauea, but not the main crater, started dumping lava in the 80s. And by 1990, it had destroyed a subdivision in Kalapana, which is down the road from where we're sitting right now. And it's continued to pour lava into the sea at that same location for many, many years. About 9 months ago, I think it was, that flow of lava stopped out of Pu'u'o'o, and a flow of lava headed to the northeast. And there have been starts and stops.
Mm-hmm.
It flow for a while, and then where it was flowing from would stop, and then another place would open up, and lava would flow for a while, and then it'd stop. Now, this isn't a place that's easily accessible, so
there are no roads.
There's no roads to this place. People, you know, the volcano workers hike in and take measurements and things, but you know, it's a place. Anyhow, on is it the June 27th or July 27th?
No,
June. I think on June 27th, a new flow started, and they very originally named the flow after the date it started. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the June 27th flow. It started flowing in a little different direction toward the south.
Yeah.
If you can imagine, Pu'u'o'o is up the hill a ways, and we're down getting closer to the ocean.
Yeah.
And since it was heading south, that means that it's starting to see a little more gradient. So, heading toward the ocean. So, it's moved a little faster than any of the previous flows. And then a couple weeks ago, it went into what's called a crack. Remember, everything is lava on lava flow here. And after a few years, trees start to grow, but you're still sitting on old lava flows. Anyhow, when it entered this crack, it went went very, very rapidly down the crack because now it's narrow and confined. And it made another 3 or 4 miles down the crack and then resurfaced again. And when it resurfaced, it was about 2 miles from a subdivision. And since then, in the last 3 days, it's gone down into another crack. And so where that crack will come out, no one knows.
It's one of those wait and sees.
There's a little bit of history there, though. The Pu'u'o'o met in the early 80s, there was a big landowner here in Hawaii, the Campbell Estates, and they were the first of them to do commercial geothermal development. And they own Kahualea Forest, which is where Pu'u'o'o is. And where Pu'u'o'o is where they were going to drill a first well. So there was a long battle with the community up there and the Hawaiian, the Pele practitioners, because Pele is the god of the volcano.
Right.
So they lost, and as Campbell was preparing to drill, Pu'u'o'o erupted right where they were going to drill the well. And now this flow has now progressed out of Kahualea and made a straight line when that happened. Campbell Estates went to the state, and the state traded them some Hawaiian land, which was Waikeleopuna. Mm-hmm. It was the largest intact lowland rainforest in the United States at that time. And they got a permit, and they bulldozed the road into the forest, and they started drilling. Well, they didn't find much there, and there was huge community opposition, giant protests, like thousands of people would come and protest there, and because of the rainforest, it was an international issue. We had support from the Rainforest Action Network and Sierra Clubs and stuff like that. And eventually they left, but this lava flow now is heading straight for that well. It's almost, when the crack Tom was talking about, yeah, came up very near to that well, and that is a straight line to the existing power plant. Some of the Pele practitioners believe that Pele will not stop. This lava flow has been going since that time. It's never stopped, the volcano, and they don't think it will stop until geothermal is done. That's just that's a little different than what we're talking about.
More than cultural.
It might be interesting to some people.
Yeah, especially.
It'll be great to see what happens.
Yeah, I was fascinated how many Pele stories I heard when I was in Hawaii. I actually got kissed by Pele. I got a little cut on my finger, and the guy, you know, just by the crater.
Yeah.
And the guy said, "Oh, you got kissed by Pele there." But it was insane. The ground, it looked like, you know, we were on Mars or something. And as you mentioned, it's all like old, you know, lava, and it's just so bizarre to see the whole terrain. You know, everywhere you look, it's just this alien surface, if you like.
Well, and like Tom said, you know, that's all of Hawaii. That's every single, mm-hmm, you know, every forest that you see, every cliff that you see was in that stage at some point.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. You know, one thing to note, I'll just briefly explain this. These guys know about it. I think it was around the time of the Pu'u'o'o eruption back in 83. Prior to that, and in the area of Kalapana when that got destroyed, I believe it was the real estate industry kind of went, well, how do we understand what is what on this island? Mm-hmm. So they asked the volcanologist to make designations of zones. So, for example, I live in Lava Zone 1, which is the most likely to have volcanic activity. And it goes up to five? Is it five?
Seven.
So areas where there's extinct volcanoes that are never going to erupt again, like Javi, I don't know if you visited there, that would be seven. So if you live in Lava Zone 1, like I do, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt or whatever to understand that you are living in a very, very dynamic area. Although I have to say the past couple weeks are a little bit more dynamic than any of us have, or I haven't been used to this.
You know, you can't get fire insurance if you live in Lava Zone 1. A ton of geothermal adventure is in Lava Zone 1.
Yeah.
And to put that into a little more perspective, it's the Kilauea East Rift Zone, and it's one of the most unstable geological formations on the entire planet,
yeah,
as far as earthquakes as well as lava flows. And so it doesn't, at one time they want, and they still, some people probably do, want to put like 500 or more megawatts. They wanted to put the whole Honolulu power supply in the East Rift Zone. It makes just no sense. You wonder where they find these people.
Yeah. Now, remember, in geological time, things happen at a rate that we have to remember. But the other thing that's happening is that the lava, when it goes into the ocean, starts cooling down pretty rapidly. And so it has trouble getting all the way down to the floor. So lava flows typically develop into overhangs. And so occasionally whole chunks of area along the ocean will drop into the ocean.
Mm.
Huge chunks, acres and acres and acres. So, so that's another daily issue that we live with. That's going to happen where we all live someday, but yeah, hopefully not in the next two or three days.
But to know that we are just a very thin surface away from this, you know, rock so hot that it's liquid, you know, it's...
But my wife said on the way over here, she said, you know, Tom, if Pele makes this move, mm-hmm, I'm glad we moved here, and I will understand that.
Mm.
But damn, we have to stop the geothermal.
Yeah. Got her priorities.
It's true. I have so much more allowance for the lava flow and for Pele. I mean, everybody has a, like, yeah, of course, you're not going to stand, mm-hmm, in that way. But the geothermal, that's a human-generated activity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that needs to stop.
Yes. All right, guys. Well, I think on that note, that's a lovely way to end. So, again, if you want to find out more, I'm going to put up all the information on the podcast, but go to bigislandvideonews.com. And like I said, there's about a 12-13 minute video there that really explains what's going on, and you can show your support through that.
And the PuponoAlliance.com website as well.
All right, thanks.
PunaPono.com, excuse me. Just PunaPono.com.
Spell it one more time.
PUNAPONO.com.
Lovely. All right, well, Tom, Bob, Sophia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and, you know.
Guys, I'll hear from you soon. Have a
great picture. Hey,
yo, D. That's great. All right, guys. Let's go. Have a lovely day. Take care. All right, aloha.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies on a flag or a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We'll save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee, them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep pants, and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones, and I tip all the gold and tip all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzis I've ever seen and ever known. Put the words on this place so the world can see, and that's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them a go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord. I'm growing wiser? Are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flat, if you went too far, you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again, everybody would have start love. The average man can't prove up most of the things that he chooses to speak of. And still run research and find out the root of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose start running. And the rich get stitched up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you read signs? Can you read stars? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows even though you drive cars? Can you survive against all odds now? Bible, who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it, try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming, eating, deleting, ruin. Trying to get paper, what? Gotta have land, gotta have acres, so I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch play the game like the Lakers, in a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers, you superstitious, throw so over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz, like somebody got a doll of me, sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it, sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit, a fearless, don't you try to grab hold of my soul. Like a military soldier since 7 years old, I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Damn. Savali, patience. Yeah.